This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Each week, nearly 8 million radio listeners tune in to this familiar greeting.
This is the hardest working man in radio, the fly jock, Tom Joyner.
In many ways, the Tom Joyner Morning Show is a lot like other radio and television morning programs. Comedy, music, celebrity interviews, discussion of the news of the day. What's different is the audience, which is largely African-American. Starting at a small AM station in his hometown of Tuskegee, Alabama, Tom Joyner moved upwards and onwards with stops in Montgomery, Alabama, Memphis, Tennessee, and St. Louis, Missouri. He earned that fly jock nickname by shuttling every weekday from a morning radio show in Dallas to an afternoon drive program in Chicago, then back again to Dallas to do it again the next day. Eventually, sanity prevailed, and he took his show to national syndication. Along the way, Tom Joyner became one of the most influential broadcasters in America. Among many other honors, he's the first African-American to be inducted into the Radio Hall of Fame. Later in the program, as some residents trickle back into New Orleans, we'll ask how sturdy the patched-up levees are, and we'll check back with the mayor of Petal, Mississippi, to hear how his town is doing. But first, join the conversation with Tom Joyner. If you have questions about his show, his career, or his conversations with Black America, our number here is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email, TOTN@npr.org. Tom Joyner has also just published a book called I'm Just a DJ, But It Makes Sense to Me, and he joins us now from the studios of member station KERA in Dallas, Texas, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hello.
I assume there's really been only one topic this issue this month of late, Katrina.
Yeah, we've been very, very busy doing more action. And, you know, the talk will take care of itself. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of talk going around. So what we've been doing is we've formed a relief fund. And it's really overwhelming because I don't have enough staff to keep up with it. What we did was we asked people to give for relief of the people who have taken in people and made their hearts and homes shelters to some of these evacuees. I mean, everybody didn't go to the shelters. Yeah. And after they got out of the shelters, a lot of people went to people's homes.
Yeah.
And that's where they are now with no future, no hope, you know, and nowhere to go. And the burden of these people are on the heart, on the people whose kindness, you know, have offered their homes. And so what we have done is partnered with churches around the country and asked the churches to identify the people who have 10, 15, 20 people in their house, evacuees from Hurricane Katrina. And the money has just been pouring in small donations, you know, under $100. Lots of checks, lots of transactions over the internet, and as fast as we get the money, we send it right out, to these families.
I know also you have a foundation that's been active helping historically Black colleges and universities, and there, I believe, are three of those in the New Orleans or immediate surroundings who've been affected by this, and I know your foundation has been reaching out to help their students reestablish themselves, perhaps temporarily, at other institutions.
Dillard, Xavier, and Southern of New Orleans were all flooded and closed, like everything else in New Orleans, and these students were displaced. What we did with the foundation is we put $1 million into a relief fund, and for any student that has had to transfer, we're giving them $1,000 in scholarship money toward tuition, books, and fees, no matter what school they are transferring to, be it another HBCU or mainstream institution. And but that's only 1,000 people. Now we're getting money from small donors with the foundation too, but most of the foundation relief money comes from us, and it's $1 million. And that's only 1,000 students, and there's some 8,700 students that have been displaced. So we're doing what we can, you know, trying to be proactive, and you know, the talk about how the government didn't respond and whether it was racist or not in the response, that will continue to mm-hmm. go. What we're more concerned about is what about you know, these displaced people's future?
Immediate needs, of course, but
immediate needs and needs of the future.
I did want to ask you, though, we're putting together a program later in the week called what Have We Learned from Hurricane Katrina? And I wonder, from your vantage point, we wanted to talk about some of the questions of race and class that have obviously been exposed. Even the president was talking about them the other night. What do you think has been exposed about America by this situation?
Well, the obvious, and I don't think I can add anything to what everybody has seen or heard. That we're not prepared for a response. We're not prepared to respond to a disaster like this.
Mm-hmm.
That the poor, and especially black and poor, are not on the radar screen. And that this catastrophe has exposed that. I think that mainstream America now realizes that there are black people like the black people in New Orleans in every city in America, and it happened to New Orleans. But if something like this happened in any other city, you'd have the same consequences, where there are poor black people who were, you know, out of work, out of hope, now flooded, and you're going to have problems. Hmm. And now these people have been displaced all over the country. And are they going to go back? And what are they going to go back to? Are they going to have a place? Did they have a place before they left? Most of them didn't. And now they probably have to settle where they are and start all over again.
Our guest is Tom Joyner. He's got a new book out in addition to the morning radio program he does every day.
I haven't had a chance to promote that book very much because the book was released when Katrina hit. And I haven't even talked about the book much on my own show.
Well, you're ignoring an opportunity. And you got to let me say the name of the book every once in a while if you want to sell a few copies. It's called I'm Just a DJ, But It Makes Sense to Me. And one of the things that I found fascinating in reading some of the book was you describe yourself as a child of the civil rights movement. And really, your career started with a demonstration at a radio station.
Yeah. Yeah. advocacy is the kind of radio I do.
Mm-hmm.
And black radio has always been like that. And I got into radio as a result of a protest march. My little hometown of Tuskegee, which is 99.9% black, has a radio station. And at the time, it only played music for the 1% of the people who controlled all of the commerce in the town, the people that controlled the stores. Those were the advertisers, and that's who they programmed to. And so, you know, we had an all black town with a radio station playing Lawrence Welkin, Enoch Wright, and no Motown, no Aretha, no Wilson Pickett. So it was customary back then in the 60s for the children to participate in some kind of civil rights march every weekend. And that's what we would do, whether it was desegregating a church or a lunch counter. And this particular Saturday, it was putting some black music on the all-white radio station. So we're out there marching. And the guy comes out who owns the station. He says, all right, look, I'll let you. It was a daytimer.
Mm-hmm.
you know, so sun up to sundown. He says, on Saturdays, I'll let you play all the Motown and all that stuff you want to play from noon to sundown. Who wants to do it? And I raised my hand, and I've been in radio ever since.
Was that the last time you got along with a program director?
You said at the top that I'd been a lot of places.
Yeah.
So I guess you could figure out that I hadn't been getting along with a lot of program directors because I've been on a lot of jobs. But not lately.
Not lately. I think they like the audience figures. Let's get some listeners in on the conversation. 800-989-8255 or email us, totn@npr.org. We'll talk with Anthony. Anthony calling us from Minneapolis.
Hi, good morning. A pleasure to be on.
Hi.
Love your show, and I've listened to it all over the country and most recently in Minneapolis, only on the Internet. So I love your show. But I want to know if you can speak to the kind of what you guys were just talking about, this idea of the history and legacy of a segregated economy, and that in some regards, black radio kind of the last bastion of that and is changing. And is there anything that traditionally black colleges can learn from that model or that experience that's going to help them flourish, because it sounds like they're in trouble? So I'll listen on the air.
Okay, Anthony, thanks for the call.
Yeah, my beloved black colleges are in trouble. And one of the dreams that I have is to save all black colleges. Right now, I'm living a dream by helping students in black colleges. But, you know, the more we save students in black colleges, the more apparent it becomes that we've got a bigger job to do, and that is to save the black colleges, because they're closing. They're losing their accreditation. They're falling in, you know, into financial slumps, and we're raising money to keep students in schools that doors may be closed, and I think that's because our beloved black colleges are not serving our community the way they should. There was a time when you know, a black student could only go to a black college because mainstream institutions didn't accept them, and that's why they were there. And they were there for them then because that was what we needed. And it's a different time now, and integration came along, and our black colleges suffered the most.
We'll continue talking about this after we come back from a short break with Tom Joyner. Again, 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our guest this hour is Tom Joyner, host of the Tom Joyner Morning Show and author of I'm Just a DJ, But It Makes Sense to Me. Of course, you're invited to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. And when you talk about the beloved historically black colleges and universities, well, you attended one of those.
Oh, yeah. I'm a product of a black college. I'm a product of a black college town. I graduated from Tuskegee. I was born and raised and educated in Tuskegee. So was my brother. My mom and dad graduated from black colleges. Both sets of grandparents graduated from black colleges. Both my sons graduated from black colleges. I have nieces and a nephew who will go to a black college because he doesn't have any other choice. So, you know, you cut me, my DNA says historically black college.
And if you hadn't graduated, though, you might have been a big star in the music business.
Oh, you read that part.
I did read that part.
I was in school with a group called the Commodores.
Lionel Richie and company.
Lionel Richie and I are both from Tuskegee. We were born the same year in the same hospital. We went to school together. And when we entered Tuskegee, we were in a freshman talent show. He was with a band and I was with a group. And after the freshman talent show, we got together and we were a show. And review. Remember back in the days, the show and review?
Right. Tina Turner had one, yeah.
Right. Well,
Johnny Otis, too, yeah.
The same thing. Okay, so we were the Commodores and the DuPonts, show and review. and we were in school. And we would play on weekends, and whenever we were on vacation, we would travel. And we would travel to New York and, you know, play Christmas holidays, Thanksgiving holidays. Well, we went to Smalls Paradise, the famous Smalls Paradise.
Up in Harlem, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And there were a couple of guys interested in managing us. One was a gangster. He wanted to manage the singing group. That's us. And the other guy was a local merchandise guy, and he wanted to manage the Commodores, but he wanted the Commodores to go back to school. And so my folks said, you know, you need to quit this group and go and get your education. I said, what about the Commodores? And he'll quit them too. So I quit. And they went on to make lots of music, and I eventually went on to play their music. I've always been jealous.
Because as much fun as you have on the radio, it's not as much fun as standing in front of a big band on a stage with a couple of thousand people screaming.
Well, you know, Neil, I think I speak for you, too. As radio people, we fantasize.
Yes, indeed.
We fantasize a lot when we're on the air. If we're playing music, we fantasize that we could play the music ourselves. We play our air guitars.
Wait a minute. You got in trouble once for reporting your air guitar stolen.
You did read the book. I went to work one. This is one of those wild times. I went to work one time, and I said my air guitar was stolen.
It's not exactly B.B. King and Lucille we're talking about here.
No, air guitar.
Yeah.
Imaginary air guitar. Yeah, I opened up the mic, and I don't know what, I just decided to say, you know, my air guitar is stolen. And I took the bit even further. I called the police and on the air. And before I could hang up the phone and call them back and tell them, you know, I was just joking, there was a cop at my door. Well, I had to continue with the bit. He came in. He wants to fill out the report. He says, what was stolen here? I said, air guitar. He said, what color? I said, transparent. What's the value? Priceless. Priceless. And I said, all I got here, and I have nothing. Well, by the time he got back to the police station, everybody was calling him all kinds of Barney Fifes and everything. So they arrested me for making a false report, and I did my time, Neil. I did my time.
You've done your service to society. I'm glad to hear about that.
I did my time, yeah.
Let's get some callers back on the radio. 800-989-8255, you'd like to join us. Let's talk with Skip. Skip calling from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hey, good afternoon. How's everyone there?
All right.
Phoenix.
Nice to talk with you, Tom. I used to listen to your show. It's no longer on the air here in Phoenix, so
yeah,
maybe you can do something about that, man. We need you.
Trying every day.
Yeah, definitely. Listen, I wanted to say something, man. You may not agree with me, but I think that as we get what we have fought for throughout the civil rights struggle, that the black colleges are going to have an inherent lack of relevance as everything equals out. I mean, it is a part of the history, and no one can take that away. But I think that as things start to get more and more equal, and as we are integrating ourselves into society and accepted as doing such, you know, it's going to ring the death knell for the historically black college.
Our black colleges have to step up to the needs of our community, today's needs. You know, that's what they were designed to do, but the needs have changed. Gone are the days when a student can graduate from high school and then leave and do 4 years of college, you know, go away to school and do 4 years of college. A lot of the students who are graduating from high school have children of their own, you know,
sure.
And responsibilities of their own. If not being a parent, taking care of their own parents, and all kinds of responsibilities, and it's just tough, and that's why schools like the University of Phoenix are so attractive to our to our students today, because they're designed for working adults, and our black and our and what I want to do is to do a black college version of a University of Phoenix. I'll just put it out there. That's what I would like to do, and that's what I'm planning on doing. I got money invested in strategic studies now.
I agree with you. I think it would be beneficial to do it that way, and I think that's the only way that it will remain relevant and available to our youth. I want to thank you for your time. I'm going to listen
thank
to the
you.
Rest of the show.
Thanks for the call, Skip.
All right. Bye.
See what people are reduced to when your show goes off the air? They have to listen to NPR.
We're on in 115 markets. Most of them are in the Southeast, where most African Americans live. We're not on the West Coast. We're in Las Vegas and a few other cities on the West. But most of our market is in the Southeast. We got Philadelphia and Chicago and Detroit and Cleveland. But I'd say the pocket of my audience is right there in the Southeast, right there where Katrina hit and displaced.
Indeed. Here's an email question we got from Mike Square in San Antonio, Texas. Do you see a future for your type of radio personality? And if so, how will they overcome the canned radio formats that media giants are forcing onto the public? In other words, the question, from where will your successor come? He says, I have experience in talk radio, but getting back into the business these days is extremely difficult.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't do talk radio. I'm supposed to be more music, less talk, but I talk. and that is a problem for someone coming along today. If they talk, they're probably, and they're in music radio, they're reduced to just, you know, giving time and temp, as we say in the business. And that's a shame, because black radio is what I do. Black radio is all I've ever done, and black radio has always been a part of the community that it serves, in every way, and not really given a lot of credit for it, because it's just kind of there and you just, you know, don't pay attention to it. Mm-hmm. I say in the book, and I say say all the time, that the civil rights movement does not. When you look back on the civil rights movement, you don't see the history of black radio as it pertains to the civil rights movement, and black radio was very important. After all, how would Dr. King and the civil rights leaders back then get the word out? You know, there was no NPR, there was no CNN, there was the 6 o'clock news, but they mm-hmm. weren't putting on the news that Dr. King's going to be on Dexter Avenue, marching up to, you know, the Capitol steps in Montgomery, Alabama. You know, going across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and he can make the announcement in his church, but there were no mega churches. A church congregation might be 100, 200 people. It was black radio, and when we were on the air, if Dr. King or anybody came by, we would stop the music and give them the microphone, and that's how people knew where to go, when to be there, and what we were there for, and that's the kind of radio I do today. Basically, with a much broader reach, but it's the same kind of radio.
But to get back to the question, how does that idea survive when one studio in Dallas or any other mm-hmm. place in the country will program dozens of radio stations across the country and sound as if they're local by giving the local traffic and temperature?
Yeah, yeah. I wish we did have a farm team. I don't know where the next Tom Joyner show is coming from, you know, and I worry about that. When I listen to hip hop radio, mm-hmm. When I listen, you know, to other urban AC format.
Adult contemporary, for those of you who don't speak radio.
Okay. The old R&B station.
There you go.
You know, and I just hear a lot of music, And I don't hear the involvement that black radio has always been about. I worry about that.
Because your experience growing up, I mean, you worked in newsrooms. You were reading a rip read at the editor's desk, maybe. But
Neil, I came up in a time when before radio became such a big corporate conglomerate where you only have four or five big companies that control all of the radio stations, and people and these corporations worry more about bottom line than they do content. You know, I came up in a time when, you know, you could do something wrong and you might not, if you got fired, you could get another job. You know, in fact, if you did something wrong, it looked good on your resume.
At times.
Yeah. You know, but now, you know, you can't make a mistake. You're only as good as your last ratings, and they do ratings four times a year, and so it's a different day now.
We're talking with Tom Joyner. His new book is I'm Just a DJ, But It Makes Sense to Me. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. There's a section in the back of your book, some of the things you've learned doing the show. And I wanted to ask you about a couple of them. Root for the home team.
Yeah.
When rooting for the sports team, the rule is as follows. We root for the home team that represents a city where we're heard.
Yes.
For example, the Miami Dolphins playing a team from Wyoming. I don't know that there are any teams in the NFL from Wyoming. But anyway, we'd be for the Dolphins if both teams are from markets where we're heard. We root for the team that has the most black starters. If both teams have a lot of black starters, we root for the team with a black coach. If both have black coaches, we root for the team with the coach who attended an historically black college or university. This goes on. There's a form of black African American nationalism in this aspect.
I guess you could say that. Yeah, yeah. African American pride would be another way of putting it.
Mm-hmm.
Super serving an African American audience. Yeah, I like that. Because if we don't, who will? And so that's a rule that we have. Because my show is in all of these markets, and I run the show as if I'm in that market. So who do I root for when, say, you know, all right, Atlanta plays Philadelphia, and you got two starting black quarterbacks, Vic and McNabb. You don't have a black coach. So it's Philadelphia, because that's the largest market.
Here's another one. Here's another saying. Move out of your old neighborhood, but spend your money there.
Right. And go back as often as you can. But don't be afraid to be like the Jeffersons and move on up. There's no shame in that, you know. But come back to the neighborhood as often as possible and spend your money with black people in your neighborhood as often as possible.
And just in case you begin to think that Tom Joyner does an entirely serious radio program, another one of his observations is, don't fry chicken naked.
And then I think I put something else on there, but if you do...
Forget what I said earlier and make sure to make a videotape of it. Yeah.
Right. Because I said earlier, stop all this videotaping. It's just getting people in trouble. And then I said, if you do fry chicken naked, forget that. Videotape it. I'd like to see that.
We just have a minute or so left with you. I did want to ask you, where do you see the future of your program? You talked about developing an online college for African Americans, but where do you see your program going?
The radio or the television?
Well,
now, I've got so many projects going here, and when you say...
we're partial to radio here.
The radio show is... Well, we just took it... We're in control of our own destiny as we have formed our own company, and we distribute and sell the show ourselves. So... And then we sold half the company to Radio One,
mm-hmm.
and now we're a part of that. So I've got a personal service contract for 10 years, and I'm like only a year into it. So for the next 10 years, I'm going to be on the air with the OOO Tom Joyner Morning Show. After that, now I'll probably re-up and I'll keep doing it. And, you know, even from the grave, I'll have a show.
We'll tune in, Tom, especially for that last part. That sounds interesting. Good luck with the program, and good luck with I'm Just a DJ,
Thank
But It Makes Sense
Thank you for having
me.
This is great. I never thought I'd be on NPR talking about a book I wrote.
Again, congratulations.
Thank you.
When we come back from a short break, we'll talk about the levees in New Orleans. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.